What I want to do is to sort of suggest some reasons that we might have for worrying a little bit about whether there could be such a thing as conceptual art, properly so called. I'm not really, as it were, here to defend the claim that it is a contradiction in terms, but rather to, as it were, set out some reasons that might push us in the direction of wondering whether it isn't a bit of a contradiction in terms. And the route that I want to take, as it were, to getting us towards that suspicion, at least, is to say a few things about the philosopher who I think was the most important philosopher of art of the 20th century. Because although he was living at a time when conceptual art was, if you like, first coming on the scene, it seems not to have hit his radar at all. He doesn't seem to have noticed it. Or if he did notice it, he decided it was entirely beneath his notice, and so he didn't register it, didn't say anything about it. But I think that whether by accident or by design, some of his really central thoughts and central insights about art do have quite immediate and quite radical sort of ramifications for the way that you might think about conceptual art. So, and apologies then if this is a little bit roundabout. So the way that I'm going to start is by, if you like, laying out some of the very basic bare bones of Collingwood's way of thinking about art, and then, if you like, try to tease out of those bones some consequences for the ways in which we might think about conceptual art. So that's kind of going to be the route. Well, it will be if I remember to do what I've just said. that's what I'm currently thinking, that the route might well be. Okay, so what gets Collingwood going? I mean, it's often a good idea with these sort of thinkers to ask, you know, what's the motivation? What's bugging them? Why have they, A, started to think about this stuff at all, and B, why have they started to think about it in the way that they do? And in Collingwood's case, the answer to that, the answer to, you know, why does he address, if you like, issues about art at all? The answer is, in his case, that he thought that art could play not only a distinctive but an absolutely vital function in the healthy operation of a culture. And his idea, just very much in a nutshell, I'll say a little bit more about this in a minute, but his idea was that the role that art played, and this indispensable role that art played, was in allowing us to get clear about various thoughts or various feelings that we might have, which sounds like a very simple goal. And in many ways, Collingwood does think it's a simple goal, but he thinks it's very important that you think about how you go about arriving at that goal very carefully, because he thinks it's incredibly easy to go wrong, and that if you do go wrong in the way that you think about, as it were, bringing off that goal, then if one thing is guaranteed, then what's guaranteed is that you're not going to get clear, actually, about anything at all. So if you think, as Collingwood did, I mean, Collingwood spoke about this in, if you like, very, very, very heated rhetorical terms. He was writing in the 1930s, and, you know, he looked around at the rise of European fascism and thought that what we had on our hands was an actual epidemic of unclear thinking and unclear feeling. And so if you thought, as he did, and as many of us presumably would, that the rise of fascism was an ugly spectacle, something to be resisted or deplored, then that accounts in part for the temperature of Collingwood's rhetoric when he sort of thunders about how vital it is for us to gain clarity. Because, I mean, you know, you exist in a certain sort of fog, his view, then you're likely to be seduced by these sorts of, you know, unclear ideologies of one sort or another. So that's just purely contextual. But I think that what he has to say, as we're in pursuit of that kind of thought, is something which detaches from its context perfectly nicely and indeed encapsulates some really deep insights into the nature of art. So that's kind of what got him going. That's why he thought it was important to talk about art. And much more locally, what he thought was, you know, he looked around at the ways that people had written about and thought about art, and he didn't like any of it. And what he didn't like, in the end, was that they all made, according to him, the same sort of basic mistake, that they all misconceived, if you like, the nature of making art in the same general kind of way. And his sort of characterization of the mistake that they made was, as he puts it, that they're all committed to what he calls a technical theory of art. So, first question then, what's a technical theory of art? Well, Collingwood's claim is that, and he claims this goes right back to Plato and Aristotle, you know, it's been the only story in town, at least according to him, that a technical theory of art, in a sense, aligns the business of art making, or of artistry, with craft, with a certain kind of, as well, way of going about making stuff in general. And he thinks that even though the aestheticians and the philosophers of art have thought there have been quite special features about the way that art is made and what artistry involves, that nevertheless, at bottom and underpinning all of the pictures that they offer, is this kind of commitment to the thought that art is at bottom a kind of a craft. And Collingwood wants to say, look, there's all the difference in the world between an art and a craft. And if we think about art making along the model of craft making, then we're going to get art wrong. And that's going to matter a little way down the line about the way we understand the ability of art to achieve the kind of clarity that Collingwood thinks is its chief, if you like, its chief purpose. So what he spends a lot of time doing is distinguishing art and craft. And he does it in lots of very subtle ways and lots of very careful distinctions, none of which it would be useful or indeed possible to kind of recap. But I can give you something of the headline news by looking at a couple of the distinctions that Collingwood thinks are kind of crucial. And it's a little bit confusing that these distinctions themselves involve distinctions, but I hope that what I'm going to say won't be impenetrable. Or if it is, it's just my fault, okay? Because the ideas are not that hard. So what he does is he picks up on a number of characteristics which he thinks are kind of definitive of the sort of making that goes on in craft. And what he wants to claim is that those characteristics, although they can feature in the making of art, are never essential to the making of art. So they may be there, but they're in a certain sense accidental features. They're not, if you like, of the very nature of art that it should have these characteristics. Whereas in the craft case, he wants to say, the characteristics that he's picking out really are of the nature of craft. They're of the essence of craft. Now, as I say, he mentions many, many, many characteristics. I'm just going to mention two. The first of these, the first of the two that I'm going to mention, is, according to him, craft always involves a very particular understanding of the difference between means and ends. So, the claim that he makes is that it's not just that there is a distinction between means and ends in making craft. It's rather that the means, as he puts it, are left behind when we reach the end product. The means are not, as it were, still present in any sense in the end product. And you think, well, hang on, you know, what does he mean there? And I think we can get a sense of what he means if we, you know, imagine a particular instance of someone making someone making a craft object. So suppose, you know, I'm making a table or something of that sort. And we might say, okay, well what are my means? Well, amongst my means might be something like a saw. So let's concentrate on a saw and maybe a hammer, something of that kind. So I saw up the bits of wood into the relevant sizes. And then, and this is not going to be a very good table, okay? I mean, I saw them to the right sort of sizes, and then, you know, bash a few nails into them until it's all aligned and stands nicely, and then presumably give it away. Now, the thought about the means being left behind here is that, from the point of view of the finished table, it just doesn't matter what saw I used. It doesn't matter whether it was a hand saw or an electric saw, or some sort of magic laser saw. It really doesn't matter. I mean, all that counts is that I end up with a table having certain kinds of proportions and certain sorts of characteristics, which are, in a strong sense, independent, those characteristics, of how they were in fact arrived at. So, as a matter of fact, we can imagine I put the nails in using a hammer. But equally, you know, I could have used a kettle or my mother-in-law. You know, so long as it had the function of driving the nails in and holding the table together, you know, our interest in the table is not an interest in the hammer with which it was put together or the saw with which the various bits were chopped up. So in that sense, we've got what Collingwood thinks of as a strong distinction between the means and the ends. So the means are simply a route to get to the end. And so long as the means, as it were, fulfil the function that they're required to fulfil, that's the end of our interest in them. The finished object we can think of with total indifference to how they're in fact arrived at. And Collingwood wants to say, look, that just isn't the case when we're thinking about works of art. That the means, as it were, aren't just left behind. They don't just become irrelevant to the finished product. They're still, in some sense, imminent to the finished product. And that an interest in the finished product will often be, at least in part, an interest in the means by which it was arrived at. So what kind of example might you have to, as it were, get a sense of what Collingwood's talking about there? Well, one example would be, if you think of a Van Gogh self-portrait or something of that kind, you might say, okay, well, what were his means? What stands in the place of means? What's his equivalent of a saw? Well, presumably his equivalent of a saw is, for example, a paintbrush. And that seems perfectly plausible. So we can distinguish between the means, namely the paintbrush, and the end, the finished self-portrait. But the brushstrokes aren't, if you like, just themselves a means to the end of arriving at the finished self-portrait. Rather, the finished self-portrait, at one level, just is the sum total of the brushstrokes which make it up. And so an interest in Van Gogh's painting is going to be almost inevitably an interest in those sort of peculiar short stabbing movements by which the paint was clearly applied. And to think that, as it were, the process that went into the painting has somehow been passed beyond when we look at the painting itself looks, in that case, to be quite clearly mistaken. The process is still fully visible on the surface of the painting, and that a large part of the interest that we take in the painting is, if you like, guided and controlled and informed by the process by which we can see it came about. And in that sense, he wants to say, that's just quite different from the sorts of interest that we might take in a craft object. Now, of course, I might, when I'm making my table, you know, and using a handsaw, saw the various bits in ways, let's say a little bit incompetently, and so in ways in which, if you like, the trace of my work is still left on the table. You know, I haven't made a beautifully smooth edge. Well, it's all a bit rough because I've been doing it like this, and I haven't bothered to sand it properly, and so on and so forth. And all of those things, you know, might be quite discernible in the table. But our interest in the table is not standardly going to be an interest in those sorts of features of it. It's going to be an interest in, can you stand stuff on it? Is it level? Is it the right kind of height? It's going to be the sorts of, if you like, facts about the table, features of the table, which are quite independent of how the table was actually made, how the table was actually arrived at. So that's one sense in which Collingwood thinks that what is absolutely distinctive of craft, namely this thought that the means are left behind once the end is achieved, is, he wants to say, at least quite possibly not the case when we're thinking about art. So he doesn't want to claim that art never involves that sort of distinction between means and ends. It's just that if it does, that's not essential to it. That's kind of an accidental feature of some particular piece of art that it does. And so centrally and most characteristically, he wants to say, an example like the Van Gogh, that's my example, not his, but is much more characteristic of art in general, that the means by which it was achieved, as it were, are still there and are still part of what is of interest in the object that was arrived at. So that's one way that he thinks that art is interestingly different from craft. The other way that I'm going to mention is, again, in terms of a distinction, which he calls the distinction between planning and execution. And again, the thought is that this is absolutely central to the notion of craft and at most incidental to the notion of art. And so there the idea is that in any case of craft properly so called, there is a stage which we can identify, a stage which is quite independent of the actual making, which we can think of as planning. So, you know, if I'm a craftsman setting about making my table, I plan it in some detail. You know, I know what height I want it to be. I know what dimensions I want it to be. And I'm going to cut my bits of wood, you know, according to those bits of pre-planned, you know, pre-planning. So if I were to set about a table, making a table, saying, you know, I want it to be roughly between 2 and 4 feet high and a yard or two long and squarish, I mean, that would be a very peculiar way of setting about, you know, making a table. And whatever else you might want to say about it is that somebody who's planning involved no more than that would be really, really, really unlikely to end up with a table. And certainly unlikely to end up with a table that anybody would want or have a use for. So instead, you know, we want to say, look, I have an actually precise idea of the height I want it to be, and I'm going to measure these things carefully to make sure that it is. I have an absolutely clear idea about the dimensions I want the surface to be, and I'm going to cut everything accordingly. So I plan it out first, and then I execute that plan, and if I'm competent, what I end up with is a table which matches the plan that I began with in a more or less satisfactory way. So he wants to say, look, that's just characteristic of craft across the board, that you can specify what the end result is going to be. You can specify it in detail, what the end result is going to be. So in other words, you can plan thoroughly for the arriving at the end result. And then you select the means that are appropriate in light of your conception of the end, namely appropriate in the light of your plan, and you execute that plan using whatever your means should happen to be. Now again, I mean, Collingwood wants to say that that's just not essential to art making in the way that it is to craft making. Of course it's the case that there is something that we might call planning when artists make works of art. But Collingwood wants to say two things. He wants to say, one thing is that there needn't be. I mean, his example is, you know, suppose you've got a wheel and some clay on it, and you're just kind of absent-mindedly fiddling about with it while, you know, making the wheel go round. And you sort of look at it, maybe you're thinking about something else, or you're listening to some music, and then you sort of look at it and think, that's rather good, I'd rather like that. Yeah. Oh, if I did this here, that would be, yeah, that would be even better. So you end up with something which you might, as it were, take to be, you know, a creative art object in some way, but which you just didn't arrive at by in advance deciding what it was that you wanted to do and then set about executing the plan that you had in mind. And it just came about more or less by accident, and you thought, yeah, you gave it the thumbs up. You also say, look, that could be a work of art, and that clearly involved no distinction between planning and execution. To the extent that there was any planning at all, it was kind of a part of the execution once you'd already discovered that accidentally something like this was going on. But that would be a bit of a strange case. I mean, so most works of art are not made by accident in that way. So most works of art, you'd want to say, well, they do actually involve a distinction between planning and execution. And Collingwood's going to agree with that. But he's then going to say that the relationship between planning and execution is just interestingly different in the two cases, the cases of craft on the one hand and art on the other hand. And the difference is this, that in the case of craft, you can specify, he wants to say, specify exhaustively what the characteristics the finished product is going to have, which will count as having succeeded. So, I want a table that's flat, I want a table that doesn't wobble, I want a table that's 3 foot 2 inches high, and 4 foot by 6 on the top. I mean, we can specify exactly what it is that I'm aiming at. And then any table which I make, which ticks all of those boxes, which I've, as it were, specified in the planning stage, any object that satisfies those conditions is going to count as the object that I had planned. So we can say in advance exactly what boxes the finished product has got to tick in the case of craft making. That's the claim, at any rate. Whereas in art making, he wants to say, we just can't. We can't do it like that. And there are two sorts of reasons why we can't do it like that. One is rather deeper than the other. And the less deep of the two is that it's no objection to a work of art if, having planned it out and having, if you like, decided which tick boxes are relevant to what you're setting out to do, if in the process of making it, you change your mind. Or if in the process of making it, it turns out that it would be better that it had this feature rather than the feature that in advance you thought it was going to have. That's no objection to the process of art making. If it, as it were, develops as you go along, and so you come to have a different conception of it from the one that you began with, that's fine. It's the kind of thing which is almost routine. That's what happens when artists work. Whereas if a craftsman did that, you know, suppose I went and ordered from a craftsman a table of this and this and this and this size, and I came back, you know, 5 days later to pick it up, and I found a table that was sort of half the height but 17 times the surface area, and the beaming craftsman saying, there you go, I wouldn't be very pleased. Presumably, I wouldn't be very pleased. And if the craftsman said to me, yeah, but no, when I was doing it, you know, I just thought, how much nicer it would be if it was completely different from what I promised. And you think, right, okie dokie. I mean, this would be an unsatisfactory transaction with a craftsman. And I take it that in the relevant sense, it wouldn't be an unsatisfactory interaction with an artist. But that, if you like, is less interesting of the two reasons why exhaustive planning, according to Collingwood, can't really play the same role in art as it does in craft. So we've got this thought that, yep, you might change your mind as you go along. The whole project might develop as you go along. But that's really just a symptom, according to him, of a deeper problem. And the deeper problem is that there's a strong sense in which the kind of plan that you'd have to have in order to end up with, in order for it to play the same role as planning plays in craft, is something which is, strictly speaking, impossible. And this takes us to this notion of clarification. Because Collingwood's idea is basically this, that if, and I haven't given you his argument for this, and in a way I don't mean to, we can talk about it in discussion if you like, but I haven't given the argument for this. He thinks that art is a process of what he calls expression, where expression, he thinks, is a process of clarification. So this is kind of a technical notion of expression in a way, but I think we can recognise it quite easily. So suppose I've got a vague thought or a muddled thought or something like that, and I want to get it clear. Well, one of the things that you'd be, as it were, tempted to say that the process of clarification would involve would be finding a suitable expression for this thought, finding a way of putting it that captures all of the things that I want to capture and none of the things that I don't want to capture. In other words, being precise. And that's an example of what Collingwood means by expression. That expression is, if you like, getting clear about, getting precise, something which was previously vague or inchoate or in some way or other muddled. So expression for him can work in terms of thought, as in the example I just gave, trying to express a thought clearly. But it can also work at the level of feeling, according to him. So, a lot of the time, he thinks, we are rather passive with respect to our feelings, rather passive with respect to our emotions. We're kind of the victims of them, rather than anything else. And they assail us, and they run us. They govern us in a certain sort of way. And he thinks that that's not, if you like, the best place to be. And part of the reason why he thinks it's not the best place to be is because an emotion or a feeling which you have that kind of relation with is not one which you're free to, if you like, endorse or reject. It controls you rather than you controlling it, or it takes control of your life away in a certain sense. And so we thought that in most cases we're very passive and very idle with respect to our feelings. You know, we know what kinds of things they are. Yeah, you know, I'm kind of fed up today. And someone might say, well, why? So, oh, I don't quite know, but just got out of bed the wrong side, or maybe it was something that was said last night. And then we forget about it and move on to other things. And for most day-to-day purposes, that's absolutely fine. But Collingwood wants to say, look, that's an emotion which has been sort of sensed, it's been gestured at, but it certainly hasn't been clarified. It hasn't, as it were, been made precise in the way that we would talk about it if it received proper expression. It just receives some kind of casual betrayal rather than a precise expression. And so this is, as I say, a technical notion of expression, this where expression kind of means clarification. And if you think about the planning-execution distinction in the context of clarification, then one starts to see, if you like, the deep reason why Collingwood thinks that art and craft are very importantly different. So suppose I start out with a muddled thought, an unclear thought. And suppose I say, okay, I don't want this to be an unclear thought. I want this to be clarified. I want this to be precise. I want to get this absolutely nailed, this thought. Well, you might say, well, that's a plan. Okay, I have a plan to clarify this currently unclear thought. And if I succeed, if I've executed my plan, then what I'll end up with is a clear thought. A thought that's been, if you like, precisely and not just vaguely expressed. And you might say, well, that looks just like a planning execution thing, as in the craft case. I want a table this size, this height, and once I've executed my plan, I end up with a table that's of the relevant dimensions. So superficially, they look exactly the same. But, of course, they're not the same, because I can't specify exactly what it's going to be to clarify the thought that I'm currently muddled about. Why not? Well, if I could specify that, if I could specify exactly what was going to count as a clarified version of this thought, I'd have already clarified it. And so the process of expression would be already complete, and so wouldn't have to be embarked upon. There wouldn't be any execution required. So this thought that actually, you can say in general terms what you're up to. I'm trying to clarify such and such a thought. But what you can't do is give a proper, precise characterization of the end product of that process unless you've already been through that process. So what the end result is, what the end result is to be, if you like, only emerges, only becomes clear in the process itself. So I can say, look, yes, I set out to clarify a thought. Here's what I arrived at. But I couldn't have told you in advance what it was I was going to arrive at, unless I'd already done the clarifying, in which case, unless we were already there. And that is completely different from the craft case, because in the craft case, I can say precisely what it is that's going to count as a successful execution of my plan. I can give you all of the dimensions. I can give it to you in very, very, very great fine detail. But in the expression case, there isn't anything like that. I can just say in general, I'm trying to get clear about something. And so, in that sense, the end product is, if you like, transformed in the process of expression. So that's, he thinks, you know, an absolutely fundamental difference between art and craft, that the full nature of the end only arises and can only arise in the process of arriving at it. And so what we have there, and this is an example of that Collingwood gives, says, look, we're engaged in a process that's directed at a certain end. You know, so we're engaged in deliberate, purposeful activity. But what's peculiar about art, what's peculiar about the process of clarification, is that we can't say in advance what that end is exactly going to be. We just have to, as it were, recognise it when we see it. When I've got so far with clarifying a particular thought, I have to say, yep, that's it, I've got it. There we are. Or I might say, no, that's not quite it. Haven't got it quite right yet. Try again. But all the time, it's not, as it were, just random trial and error. It's directed, because you'll know it when you see it. But you can't say what the it is independently of arriving at it. So, you know, if somebody were to say to me, when I show them, if you like, the expression of my clarified thought, okay, well, what thought was it that you were trying to clarify? All I can really do is point at the clarification of it. Look, there it is. That is the clarified thought. I can't give you an independent specification of it, because that would be, if you like, exactly the sort of thing that only a craftsman can do, give you the measurements, which all of which could have been delivered in advance. So if that's what's distinctive of art, which is what Collingwood claims is distinctive of art, there's a very sort of specific stage in the art making which might involve some planning. It might involve even working out in some detail what the finished product is going to be like, but can never involve an advanced apprehension of all of the details, and can never involve an ability to state exhaustively before the process is self-complete what is going to count as a satisfactory finished product. Then, even if, as it were, there is this planning involved, the role that planning plays is just fundamentally different in the two cases. So it's not just that the plan happens to develop as you go along, or something like that. It's that you discover what the end point of the process is only at the end of the process. You can't know in advance what it's going to be. And one of the ways that Collingwood puts that is to say, and I think this is, you know, quite a deep thought, is that what's involved in clarifying a thought or a feeling, whether we do it in words, or whether we do it in paint, or do it in stone, or do it in sounds, involves an essential interaction with the medium in which one's working. And that the medium is, in that sense, integral to the process of clarification that you engage in, and therefore integral to the clarification or the expression that you end up with. So the medium is not, if you like, some incidental thing, which, you know, so he happened to draw a paint, you know, to produce a painting to clarify his thoughts about such and such, but he could just as easily have written a poem. And now, according to Collingwood, that's just, as it were, cloth-eared. I mean, that just, there's nothing that looks like that. You can't say that one, the two different media could have been used to clarify one and the same thing, because the clarification and the medium in which the clarification has been done are in the end not separable, according to his model of what artistic creativity is like. Now, I think there's a lot of good stuff in that as a way of thinking about what's characteristic of artistic creativity. And if it's true that there's quite a bit to be said for that, then it poses a particular sort of difficulty for the notion of conceptual art. Why? Well, for the fairly obvious reason that conceptual art does seem to involve a kind of a planning execution distinction of exactly the sort that we find in craft. So, you know, Damien Hirst thinks, okay, there's a cool idea. What I'm going to do is take a skull and glue loads of diamonds all over it. Now, really, it's at least very tempting to say, once he's had that idea, if you like, that's it. The work's done now. The rest is, if you like, just the mechanical business of gluing a bunch of diamonds to a skull. It doesn't greatly matter which diamond is glued where, so long as there's a relatively even covering all over. Indeed, it doesn't really have to be done by him. He could just give someone a set of instructions, and they go off and produce something which nicely matches the idea that he came up with. And if successful as an object, then we might say, yeah, okay, look, this is perfectly appreciable in some way. But Collingwood would want to say that what it was appreciable as is strictly a piece of craft, and certainly not as a work of art, because the planning and the execution are observably distinct in this case. You can give an exact specification of what it is that you're going to end up with. And, as I said, it doesn't really matter whether it's Damien Hirst who does it or his aunt, if provided that it sort of matches the idea that he began with. And another way of bringing out that point, if it's right, another way of bringing out that point is to say that because, in Collingwood's view, a clarification of a thought or the expression of a thought is inextricably bound up in the medium of expression. So if it's paintings, inextricably bound up with the paint or the stone, if it's a sculpture. Because of that, if we as an audience want to grasp or understand the thought that's or the feeling that's been clarified in a particular artwork, it's no good giving us a description of it, because the precision is, if you like, to be found only in the medium as worked during the process of clarification. So if I want to know what a painting's really like and how good it really is, or how enjoyable it is, or how rich it is, you just telling me about it, although jolly helpful and nice, isn't really going to do the trick. I've got to go and see for myself. I've got to go and look. I've got to go and stand in front of it and see, as well, how it works on me, see what I can see in it, and moreover, see what sorts of traces of the artistic process are imminent to the art object which I'm looking at, which, again, somebody could describe to me, but that's no use. I can describe to you short, stabbing brush strokes, but until you actually go and see the effect of them, then you're not going to be in a position to say whether Van Gogh clarified anything here or not. You've just got a description. And so one of the things that Collingwood was very, as it were, insistent on is this distinction between description and expression. Expression is inherently tied up with the medium of expression, whereas description is in principle completely independent of that medium. So the description of the table could be exactly the same within limits, whether it's going to be made of teak or oak or elm or whatever. We could come up with the same measurements for it. Whereas an expression, if you like, just doesn't have those sorts of detachable characteristics in that way. Now, going back to the Damien Hirst skull, or any other example like that, it's at least very plausible to say that a description of that object is all you need to think about what the Hirst achievement there is. Maybe it'd be quite interesting to see it, but it's not kind of essential to see it. You can imagine it. You can imagine it perfectly well without actually having to see it. And, you know, so the thought here is that this is just in general the case of conceptual art, that if there is anything, as it were, distinctive about seeing the stuff, actually being in its presence, well, then those are going to be sort of accidental aesthetic features which were not part of the process of clarification or expression, if there was any such going on. And that we could, as it were, from a suitably rich and full description of the object, kind of know what it was all about. There wouldn't be anything left that mattered, that required one actually to go and have a look for oneself. So if the Collingwoodian thought is right, and if my incredibly crass characterization of what conceptual art is right, then conceptual art just is a contradiction in terms. Because anything, if you like, where the artistry is complete once the thinking is over and before the actual object is cobbled together, is craft and not art. So I think that's a principled reason to worry a bit about conceptual art. And I hope I've indicated the places where you might want to try to drive a coach and horses through it as well.